Welcome to Should I Love This Comic? Hello, my name is Damien Drouet-Whiter, and with me I have...
And my name is Irigel Drouet-Whiter.
The gorgeous Irigel Drouet-Whiter as my partner in crime for this comics podcast called Should I Love This Comic? And what we do is we look at a comic from my collection and we decide, should I love it? Should it be in there? Should I still keep it? So today we're going to look at Thor issue 355. Had a cover date of May 1985. Back in the olden days, how old were you in May 1985? You would have been 9. I could do. You were very nearly 10 because you were 10 in July of 1985. But it was actually on sale earlier than that. It was on sale according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, which is a wonderful website people love who love comics. It was on sale on the 12th of February 1985. So, you know, little Damien, hello, was 10. And Irigel was 9.
Hello.
This is one that some of the comics in my collection that we've reviewed have been ones I bought off the out of the newsagents when I got it, but not this one. This is one that I got as a back issue much, much later on, because at this point in time, back in 1985, I was only reading Marvel UK comic. Were you reading comics when you were 9?
No, I was probably don't know what I was doing at 9.
So obviously what I tend to do is I go through the list of people who worked on the comic and say a little bit about their careers and stuff first. So we're going to start, let's just go through the credits. So the book is called, what's it called actually, the story?
The Mighty Thor.
Oh yeah, The Mighty Thor is the name of the title by Marvel Comics. If you open it up, we can see the title of the comic. The Icy Hearts, or My Dinners with Thor. And it's written by Walter Simonson. There's a guest artist who's Sal Buscema. There's a letterer, John Workman, colourist Christy Scheel, editor Ralph Macchio, assistant editor Bob Harris. This one came out in 1985, as I said. I just had a quick look online when I was looking at Mike's Amazing World to see what else came out at the same time, just for fans of comics who are trying to get in their head what era this was. The same point as Avengers 255, which is quite well known amongst Avengers fans, because it was the first John Buscema issue, so that's Sal Buscema's brother, who will come up, I'm sure. Daredevil was currently being written by Frank Miller. It was the same month as Crisis Number 2. So, you know, a lot of things going on. People who are comics fans will be able to, in their brains, kind of set it where it is. So let's start with Walter Simonson. Walter Simonson is the greatest superhero artist of all time. Just start with something, you know, uncontroversial and everyone would agree with. What do you think?
I would obviously agree with this point because...
He has no idea who Walter Simonson is.
Because I've been told to agree.
As if I would do that to my dear loving husband. No, Walter Simonson, I will always describe him as the greatest superhero artist of all time. He's definitely one of my favourites, and I think he's a really great talent.
Very good name.
It is a fantastic name, Walter Simonson. Or Simon Walterson. You can turn it around. It still works. What am I talking about?
Simon, what was his name again?
It's Walter Simonson.
Walter Simonson.
So well, could be... Often credited as Walt Simonson earlier on in his career.
So it could be Simon. Simon.
Simon Simonson,
Walter Walterson.
Interesting. So, no, I've said I consider him the greatest comic artist of all time for the American market, the kind of superhero comics artist. And the reason I say for superhero comics or for American comics is because I don't know enough about other types of comics to know. There might be someone who's better, but I doubt it. But the issue that Walter Simonson has with his career, with his legacy, with this comic we're going to review today, is because he's one of the greatest artists who's ever worked in comics, people underrate his writing. when he writes things, people think, oh, he's not the artist and he's the best artist in the world. So it kind of get talked about as like the secondary element. Does that make sense?
Fair enough.
You know, as a bit like, I don't know, if someone's like a great performer as a singer, maybe their songwriting sometimes gets under, kind of ignored a bit.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So it's that kind of thing. So, yeah, I consider him the greatest artist of all time. He began working in comics in 1972, originally drawing stories for the DC anthology books, which we've talked about before on other episodes of these. They were a great way in because people could do lots of little short stories as a way to start working. And within months, he teamed up with writer and editor Archie Goodwin for the Manhunter strip, which ran as a backup in Detective Comics, so the Batman book, 437 to 442, and it finished with a Batman team-up in 443. Now, it's hard to convey just how much of an impact this had. Obviously, it's before both of us were born. We've already talked about that. But you look at the history of comics and the way that people talk about Manhunter and how much of an influence that had on what happened around it and what people went on to do next. It was huge, you know, and it was the first major thing Walter Simonson drew. In the Shazam Awards, they used to have awards called the Shazam Awards that they gave away at the San Diego Comic Convention, which you'll have heard of.
I will.
We'd love to go to that at some point. Not at the moment while we're in COVID eras.
So the in the country with the highest...
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't think I want to go anywhere near America at the moment, but anyway.
Hopefully after November.
I'll be honest, I don't want to go to any comic conventions in this country either.
True, good true, point.
True. You know that one we were going to back in May?
It's been cancelled, hasn't it?
Well, it was rescheduled for this weekend and they've cancelled it in between, yes, strangely. So the Shazam Awards, I was saying, given out at the San Diego Comic Con, and they were voted for by comics creators. So they were one of the first ones that were the creators giving it, not the fans. And obviously that makes a difference. And Walter won the Outstanding New Talent Award for 1973. And the comic strip Manhunter in Detective Comics got the Best Individual Short Story Awards for both 1973 and 1974. And the Best Individual Story for 1974 for issue 443, where it was the Batman team-up and it was a big long story. So that's basically within 2 years of joining the industry, he had the respect of his peers and was considered one of the best artists in the industry. At this point, he was inking all his own art and doing all the sound effects and display lettering in his stories and offering colouring and lettering as well. During this period, he continued to move around, working on lots of different characters for lots of companies. In 1976, he began to scale back his contribution to doing rough layout pencils only on a number of projects. Now, we talked about this before, didn't we? Do you remember in the first episode?
We did.
We talked about the idea of people doing layouts and then the inker does the finishes. So most of the work's done by the inker and it's just kind of doing the basics. So he moved into doing this. I've written here, it's difficult to determine why he moved from being full artist to doing layouts only. He has talked about using it as an experiment, giving him a chance to see how his pencils would look combined with other inkers. I'm sure at least part of it would be motivated by his first assignment being with Wally Wood, who was a legendary artist. He started providing layouts on Hercules Unbound and soon expanded onto Rampaging Hulk, which was finished by Alfredo Acala, and then Detective Comics, where he worked with his ex-roommate, Alan Milgram. And then he did a 12-issue run on Thor with writer Len Wein, lots of different finishers, but mainly Tony DeZuniga. In 1979, he worked with Archie Goodwin again as writer, and John Workman as letterer and editor on the adaptation of the film Alien, the comics adaptation of Alien, which was at the time the best-selling single comic book for a long, long time. Definitely is like graphic novel format. And then after that, he became the regular artist on Marvel's Battlestar Galactica comic from issue 5 and took over as writer from issue 19. This was Walter's first comics writing credit, but he had drawn lots of comics which were written Marvel-style, where the artist draws the story from a plot synopsis. And then the writer adds dialogue in later. In interviews, a number of his collaborators have talked about how involved he was in the plotting of his earlier work. As far back as Manhunter, he had been drawing stories from a conversation with Archie Goodwin rather than a written script. He was probably helped that the editor on Battlestar Galactica was his wife, Louise Simonson, who, in addition to being a phenomenal writer in her own right, is known for being really good at working with writers to develop concepts and pace stories. He stayed on Battlestar Galactica until it was cancelled at issue 23. Did that make sense, what I just said there?
Yeah, I think so.
So the idea is he was working what they call Marvel style.
Mm-hmm.
So do you know what Marvel style means?
Style that Marvel...
But what it was basically, you know, Stan Lee wrote, like, all of Marvel.
Right.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Now, that's physically impossible. Nobody can write, like, scripts for everything.
Because so on the this way... one, for example, it says presented by Stan Lee.
Oh, it does say presented by Stan Lee. That's slightly different. That's later on when he's just a figurehead of the company.
Okay.
But when he was actually writing, so he's getting the credit of writer, but he wouldn't have had time to write a script for every single comic, you know. Working with Jack Kirby and, you know, all the other artists. So what he would do is he'd sit down with them or he'd speak to them on the phone and they'd have a quick conversation and he'd say, oh, we should do this, this and this. And then the artist would go off and create a story based upon that.
Mm-hmm.
So like a comic strip with little notes on it that said, you know, Thor hits Loki in the mouth, you know, Loki hits Thor back, written at the bottom, so that he could tell what was going on if it wasn't completely clear. And then he put the dialogue in afterwards. And it's called Marvel style because it's how the Marvel comics were done. It was how Stan Lee was able to write, you know, 6 to 8 comic books a month.
Mm.
Obviously, when you work in that format, the artist has more input on story than the writer.
Yes.
Well, maybe not more input, but has a lot more input than... if they get a full script and they're just copying a script, you know. So the fact that Walter worked like that with Archie Goodwin, who was one of the greatest writers in comics, on Manhunter, you know, he'd practiced doing a little bit of contributing to the writing before he became a writer. That's why I was trying to say. So his next major work after Battlestar Galactica, it was a run on Marvel's Star Wars book. With writer David Michelinie and finisher Tom Palmer, he produced some of the best Star Wars comics ever made. Now, these were the first things I saw that Walter Simonson worked on because they were reprinted in Marvel UK's Return of the Jedi Weekly, which was my comic when I was a kid. And it's where I learned to love his art. If you check the credits through the run, you'll see he gets credited more and more for contributing to writing. So in the first couple of issues, it's written by David Michelinie, layouts by Walter Simonson. And as it goes further on, it's like layout and plot or layout and co-writer. At the end of his Star Wars run, or towards the end, he also pencils the Marvel DC crossover book X-Men Teen Titans, which brings together each company's bestseller. This gives him his first opportunity to draw Jack Kirby's ultimate villain at Darkseid, who he'd later go on to work with a lot. By this point, it is 1983, and Walter has been working from Upstart Associates Studios since 1978. Big noise as I turn the page. His studio mate, Howard Chaykin, is starting work on a series he has created called American Flag. And another studio mate is Frank Miller, who's started working on his own creation, Ronin, for DC Comics. So it's kind of a point in comics when every major creator is working on something that they own. They're working on their own projects, not just... you know, things for the companies like Marvel and DC. Walter brings back a sci-fi concept he worked on at university called Star Slammers to create a graphic novel written and drawn by himself, lettered by John Workman, who he would work with as much as he could, and coloured by his own wife, Louise Simonson, and edited by Archie Goodwin. So you can see him coming back to working with the same people again. At this point, Walter Simonson is fully complete as a comic creator. So it's 1983. He's able to write, draw, letter and colour and surrounded by friends and creators who both inspire him and support him to produce excellent work. Luckily for comics fans, at this point, editor Mark Gruenwald is looking for someone to take over Thor. The book has been on a downward trajectory for a couple of years and was perilously close to cancellation. So Mark was happy for Walter Simonson to do as he pleased. And he did. So the issue we're looking at today is from this run, and it's what he's best known for. Thor 337 to 382 was Walter's second run on Thor, but this time he was writer as well as artist. He revolutionised the book by going back to the Norse myths and reframing them for the 80s. He changed the look of the book using real Viking design as his basis and added melodrama and humour to create a series that held all the good parts from Jack Kirby and Stan Lee's version of Thor, but was willing to go anywhere and do anything. I mean, at one point on the book, Thor turns into a frog for a couple of issues. That gives you an idea of where he was willing to go. Walter was the artist on the first 30 issues of this run, And then he worked with Sal Buscema, who draws this issue, on the rest of the run. Critics and fans agree that Walter Simonson's run on Thor is one of the best superhero runs of the 80s, and it is a perennial in comics you must read lists. I said that wrong. It is a perennial in comics you must read lists. So it's basically seen as a perennial must-read. Mm. I'm saying that really badly. After leaving Thor as artist, he drew X-Factor 10 to 39, written by Louise Simonson and inked by Bob Wycheck, at the same time as he was writing Thor. He also had a fascinatingly short run as writer on Avengers. He did 291 to 300. He came on at short notice when Roger Stern left in a hurry because one of his approved storylines was truncated, and then he left in a hurry when exactly the same thing happened to him. His next big run was Fantastic Four. It's best remembered for a three-issue fill-in story illustrated by Art Adams, featuring a new Fantastic Four made up of all the hot new characters. But I think it deserves re-evaluation of the whole run. The entire run is underpinned by a clever time travel story, which works at the individual issue level, but works even better if you read the whole thing. In the mid-90s, he spends a number of different short runs, so he starts doing a lot more short stuff, miniseries and specials. This includes his first work for Image Comics and a return to the Star Slammers in a highly respected and a highly respected four-issue RoboCop versus Terminator story he produces with Frank Miller. Now, the sign of how good this guy is, darling,
yes,
is I've never seen the RoboCop movie. No. Don't want to see it. I've seen Terminator, and I'm like, you know, don't really care. His RoboCop versus Terminator, I loved it. And the thing is, if someone's a great storyteller, they can make you love anything.
Yeah.
In 1998, he contributed to all 12 issues of Michael Moorcock's Multiverse, and he started doing various short stories in featuring Jack Kirby's New Gods, which appeared all over the place. Starting in 2000, he writes and draws the DC series Orion, which stars one of Jack Kirby's New Gods. This is a hugely underrated series, often overlooked, that needs to be read by every comics fan. As with Thor, Walter is able to build on Kirby's work, but not by rehashing it. So many people, when they do a Kirby series, they'll do what Kirby did, but do it again. They'll go, oh, we'll get the same villains in, we'll go to the same place, we'll revisit, and he always does something different. Yeah, he goes to new places and he develops, he builds upon. Throughout the noughties, he continued to do short runs as writer and or artist on various comics and also became more involved in teaching through the School of Visual Arts in New York. This led to him writing more and drawing less, because obviously writing takes less time than drawing. Mm. Since 2014, Walter has been working on a series called Ragnarok for IDW Publishing. This is a reimagination. This is a reimagining. This is a reimagining of the story of the Norse gods, starring Thor and set after the Nine Worlds are destroyed during Ragnarok. So far, it's been released as a 12-issue series called Ragnarok, and then a 6-issue follow-up mini called Ragnarok, The Breaking of Helheim. I mentioned at the start of my review that Walter Simonson won an award for Best Comic Story in 1973. 47 years later, he continues to produce vital art and stories that are among the best comics of all time. He's genuinely a comic book genius. Sal Buscema is probably the most underrated artist of the Marvel Age. So basically, we're talking about two creators here I feel are underrated. Walter Simonson is underrated as a writer, and Sal Buscema is underrated as an artist. He got his start in comics in 1969, inking his older brother John Buscema. Now, John had been drawing comics since the 40s, and he's a stone-cold legend. John Buscema is one of the most famous Marvel comic artists. So, obviously, Sal is instantly seen as a secondary talent. You know, if you're the younger brother coming in 20 years later, you're going to be underrated comparatively, I think. You know, that would be my belief. He started as an inker for John Buscema. He soon began penciling, starting with the Avengers, and became Marvel's most prolific artist of the 70s and 80s. He became prominent in an era when comics were treated as an assembly line and was encouraged to draw as much as possible, often producing 3 or 4 books a month. Due to this workload, he mainly produced layouts which were finished by the inker. So again, I was talking about that before, that way of working through the 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. I think it was harmful to Sal Buscema, because a lot of his work in this era was badly inked. and he's often underrated because of this. When he was able to ink himself or work with inkers who drew into his layouts, who really got involved, his work looks much better. So Sal is best known for a series of long runs. He was quite loyal to his series. He would stay on them for a long time. So he drew a book called Defenders for 3 years. He drew Rom for 4 years, Spectacular Spider-Man for 8 years, and Hulk for 10 years, which is amazing. You know, it's one of the longest runs ever for Marvel. That was 1975 to 1985. In between, he penciled stories for almost every Marvel series, working with every major writer and quite a few minor ones. He is known for his kinetic, action-packed panels. In particular, there's something that, on the internet, is referred to as the Sal Buscema punch, which we'll see an example of in the story. And he's also known for having absolute clarity in his storytelling. You can always tell what's going on. It's very clear. It's very direct. My favourites of his work. So, you know, you could tell with Walter Simonson, all of his work is my favourite. I'm not picking. But Sal Buscema has done even more than Walter Simonson. So I'm going to pick out a few favourites. Now, my number one top favourite of his work is his run on Thor with Walter Simonson. So this issue is the first part of that. Then he goes away for a little bit. And then he comes back as regular artist by, I think it's about issue 365, he comes on as the regular. So that run is amazing. He did Spectacular Spider-Man for 8 years, and the issues that were written by Jerry Conway, J.M. DeMatteis, who we spoke about on the last episode of this podcast, and Stephen D. Grant are the best of that. But there were other writers around there who did okay stuff sometimes. But when he had a long run with the same writer consistently, he usually did better work. One of my favourites of his Hulk run is the story that's in issues 301 to 309. It's written by Bill Mantlo and inked by Jerry Tulaiac, who's a Filipino inker whose work I really love. It was a crossroads story. It's about Hulk moving through lots of alternative dimensions. I love that one. I'll be honest, I haven't read the entire Hulk run, so there may be better stuff that I don't know. I've read from about 290 up to the end of it. And another favourite of mine is actually one that Sal didn't pencil, he inked. And there was a brief run on Fantastic Four from 298 to 300 that was written by Roger Stern, pencilled by John Buscema, and inked by Sal Buscema. But I've written here, and I do believe this, ultimately, if you buy a Sal Buscema drawn comic, you'll have fun. There's so much energy to his artwork. I think that's why the editors were trying to get him to almost overwork. So briefly as well, I'll go over the letter of John Workman. I spoke about him on episode 2 when we looked at Marvel Fanfare. Great letterer, came into comics late 70s, worked for DC for a while, then moved over to Heavy Metal where he was editor and art director. And he was responsible for getting Archie Goodwin and John Workman to work together on the Aliens adaptation. After that, from that time onwards, as much as possible, he has lettered almost everything that Walter Simonson has drawn, including this comic, which he only wrote. Just a great letterer, still working today. Most recent thing I've read by him, obviously, is Ragnarok, The Taking of Helheim, The Breaking of Helheim, even. And the colorist, Christy Scheel. Now, she was a fine artist, trained as a fine artist. And she worked for Marvel through the 80s and 90s, so for about 20 years. She did so much work. She was one of the people who just continuously was colouring comics. But she's probably best known in comics for working with Bill Sienkiewicz. No, for working with Bill Sienkiewicz, which I will say correctly, on Moon Knight, which obviously he was doing experimental artwork and she mixed with that. And she had two very long runs on Avengers and Daredevil, both of them for more than 10 years. In addition to colouring comics, she continued to be an accomplished landscape painter and has taught oil painting with specific focus on colour theory. So obviously colouring comics makes sense as something to do. Editor Ralph Macchio is not the Karate Kid, despite what Eric Gill asked me when he read this. He started working at Marvel as an...
He's a headmaster somewhere.
Who is?
The Karate Kid.
The Karate Kid, is that what he does now?
He's a teacher in school on GG or something.
No, that's not Ralph Macchio. Ralph Macchio is still an actor. And was the Karate Kid. You're thinking of Glenn Medeiros. How often do you hear Glenn Medeiros mentioned on Comics Books Podcast?
I would do.
That will not be deleted.
Nothing's gonna change my love for you. You wanna know by now how much I love you. He was very beautiful at the time, though.
Yeah, only in Irigaray's brain, but you know, Irigaray was a teenager at the time.
And I was very upset that he.
Do you think maybe we should get back to what editor Ralph Macchio did?
No.
Well, he's not the Karate Kid. Apparently, he's nicknamed Karate Kid because his friends think it's funny.
Oh, okay.
But it's pronounced Macchio with him, and it's pronounced Macchio with the actor. And he first worked for Marvel in 1976 and retired in 2011, and it actually made him the longest-serving Marvel editor overall ever, because he actually was an editor for Marvel for just over the length of time that Stan Lee was an editor and wasn't just credited as an editor, even though he wasn't there anymore. Okay, so let's start, as we mean to go on, by looking at the cover to this comic. Thor 355, cover dated May 1985. Shall we look at the cover?
That's where I come in. Hello.
Hello. So if we start with the cover, we can see it is a cover of Thor the Mighty, as it says in his logo, wrestling with Tiwaz. I'm pronouncing it Tiwaz. We had a discussion, is it Tiwaz or Tiwaz? We don't know. Write in and let us know. So no lettering on there apart from the, what's that thing at the top called? The logo.
Logo.
The logo that's designed by Alex J. I didn't mention that. I like to know who did the logos. He designed quite a few logos for Walter Simonson over the years, including the one on X Factor, number 10, that starts from there where Walter Simonson takes over. So you can see it's two characters wrestling. What was your initial reaction to this, darling?
I thought this picture was quite quite difficult to work out what was happening.
I think that's true, actually. I mean, I'm a big fan of Walter Simonson, and I've waxed his car a bit, as people say. Going on about how wonderful he is, but I must say this is not the most clear cover.
And yeah, there's a few things that you kind of wonder what's happening. It does look like Thor's punching him in the gonads.
It does a little bit. I mean, you mentioned yourself to me. I remember you saying about where his other arm was, and that's not helped by the way that the cover's coloured. Now, we don't know who coloured the cover. They don't give credits for that back then. But the way that you can't necessarily tell Tiwaz's two arms automatically when you look at it.
Yeah.
The fact that Thor's cloak is the same kind of orangey red as Tiwaz's t-shirt or vest or whatever that's meant to be, whatever's underneath his woolen cloak. And also, I'm going to call this a mistake that Walter Simonson made. It's not a mistake. But what he's done is he's foreshortened the image. So Tiwaz is closer to us and Thor is further away.
Yes.
But Tiwaz is a giant and Thor obviously is normal size. Well, he's quite tall for a man, but he's normal size. Yes, the character closest to us looks bigger. But I'll be honest, before I read this the first time, when I saw the cover, I thought it was two people of the same size fighting, and one of them looked bigger because he's closer to you. So I think it's almost like the kind of Jack Kirby effect of, like, it's bigger because it's closer to you. It's kind of confusing me a bit. It's making me think I'm looking at something different to what I am.
Yes.
I don't know. It's definitely not Walter Simonson's best cover. It's not bad.
I quite like the dynamic.
Dynamism. Yeah.
I like the ice shattering, or it could be glass, but it's ice.
It is ice when you've read the story, but it looks like glass. I mean, it's definitely true. Using the pale blue as the background gives you the idea that it's an icy place, and it also makes the figures pop. Maybe the colours they're wearing are too similar to each other to make it stand out.
On his cloak, it looks like there's something written, but I'm sure that's just...
I think that's just the texture, because obviously it's meant to be a fur cloak.
But it does look like...
Yeah, it does a little bit look like
a symbol.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I like sort of like, I mean, it's very typical of having done a few of these now, I'm an expert, kind of the kind of explosion thing that they do with lines coming out.
Yeah, kind of the motion lines. They give it a strong dynamic quality. I think it would probably stand out on out of a series of covers. And obviously sometimes not having cover lettering makes it stand out more than if you've got a big thing. So, you know, they could have put on there, this issue, Thor wrestles a giant, or they can just leave it blank. And sometimes leaving it blank makes it stand out more than if it says Thor wrestles a giant.
And you said in shops, it would just be, there would just be a pile of them up on
their
ends, wouldn't they?
The thing is, obviously, sometimes you see different bits because they're designed. We have the corner box up there. Right. And they're designed so that if you put, like, I'm just grabbing something else. So if you put like that, you'd still see Thor, you'd see the number, and then the little the UPC box, which is, that's where the barcode would be.
Right.
If it was a barcode one. Now, all the ones that come to England, like this one did, didn't have barcodes back then. So it's got a little picture of Mjolnir, his hammer. Mm. And you can see how much it was. It was 30p. So this is before I started buying comics, because they were 40p when I first started buying them. It's quite a good cover. Did you notice Walter Simonson's signature on that?
I did.
Did you notice the key thing about Walter Simonson's signature? Because he's very famous for it.
It's got an O in it.
It has got a big O. What does the shape of his signature look like? Can you tell? I'm not sure I got it until I read it.
Oh, is it the sun from... the Egyptian gods?
No, it's meant to be a dinosaur, because he's really into dinosaurs. That bit there on the N at the end is like the face of the dinosaur.
Oh, yeah.
And that's its skeleton. It's got a big middle, and that's his tail on the S.
Oh, okay.
Do you get that?
Not really.
No, he can't see the dinosaur.
Well, I can, but...
Yeah, that was the idea. And apparently that came from his mother. He was, like, practising signatures, and his mother had said something about, oh, your signature has to be noticeable if you're going to be an artist. So he made it a dinosaur, because he was really into dinosaurs.
Okay.
I mean, it's quite cool. As we say, it's not our favourite cover, but it's not bad.
No, right then.
Let's get on to the story. Shall I start by doing my little...
summary?
Synopses.
I used to fall in love with them all, the boys and those young virile laddies. But now I find that I'm all inclined to keep my mind on my daddy. Though I'm in love, I'm never above a date with a star or a cabbie. It's just a pose, cause all of them knows my heart, it belongs to my daddy. My heart belongs to daddy.
The Icy Hearts, or My Dinners with Thor. And you get lots of noises of me turning over my notes. Isn't it weird that in this modern day and age we use handwritten notes? It's only because my eyesight's terrible. Okay, so we open with Thor asleep and bandaged as the giant Tuas stands behind him and plays with his hammer. That sounds really rude, doesn't it, the way I put it?
There's a lot of filth in this.
I do apologise for that. Oh, yes, let's say Tuas stands behind him holding his hammer. No, that still sounds rude, doesn't it?
No.
Yeah. And on the opening splash page, he's in shadow, so you can't necessarily know who he is in case he's like a nasty man. He puts the hammer down just as Thor stirs and returns to carving ice sculptures, which is what he likes to do in between his time. Thor wonders if he's dead, but Tuas assures him that he isn't. He is in his home, and Tuas has rescued him from the ice and snow. Tuas tells Thor he has to wrestle for his dinner. Thor can barely stand and is quickly beaten. Tuas gets his enchanted ice servants to bring bread and broth for Thor to regain his strength. Thor and Tuas discuss the recent battle against Surtur And the fact that Odin is lost and Tuaz reveals that he knew Odin before Thor was born. So we had a really quick, catch up on the last couple of issues. We cut to New York City, where the Warriors Three are exploring. They look for a mead hall and instead find a department store. In the cookware department, they are impressed by nonstick pans, but not by the knives, which are badly balanced for throwing. Out on the streets, Beta Bill asks Sif why she is sad. She knows what happened in Asgard and has yet to tell the other Asgardian. We also get a brief look at some characters in metal suits robbing a diamond exchange, mysteriously. We cut back to Asgard, where Thor is waking and he goes for a walk with Tuaz. Come and join me for a walk. The sun is already well up in the sky and there is much to see. My home, young Thor, the sculpted ice canyons, the towering glaciers, all these are my domain. A world unto itself. Oh, I know the tales in the Golden Realm that the lands to the north are barren and lifeless. But look around you. Even here, life has everywhere gained a foothold. And where there is life, there is also death. Today, the polar bear slays the seal. Tomorrow, the bear in its turn may fall prey to the hunter. An ancient cycle, young Thor. There is no shame in living. There should be none in dying. How strange it is to stand here with someone completely unknown in Asgard, and yet feel as though my father were still here beside me. Tell me, my host, have you a name? I've had many names, young lordling. Tuaz was one that has served as well as any. Come, another cycle is complete. The sun is setting. Let us return home. When they get back in, Thor notices his hammer and realises that Tuaz must have carried it. Tuaz lies and says he got the ice servants to carry it. They wrestle again and Thor loses again. After food, Thor again falls asleep. We get a brief cut to a scene of Loki and Lorelei planning to take advantage of Odin's absence. Thor awakes the next day to see Tuaz breathing life into his ice sculpture. Thor is sure that Tuaz must be Odin in disguise, but Tuaz reminds him that all of Odin's disguises were one-eyed, just like Odin. Tuaz admits he used to be a sky god, but gave it up. He didn't want the servitude of being a leader. Thor says he knew so little about his father. And who am I if I do not know my father? Tuaz reminds Thor that it doesn't matter where his father came from or where he went. He was the father you loved, and no tale of his beginnings can change that. They wrestle again, and this time Thor wins. After eating, Tuaz says Thor must leave. The bloom hath returned again to your cheeks, and there shall be great need of thee in Asgard, now that your father is gone. I know, Tuaz, and yet I am loath to leave. I feel more at home here than I have felt in many a day. My father's loss still weighs heavily upon me. If only I had fought harder, been stronger. Tuaz reminds Thor that nothing is permanent, and one of his ice servants adds that they only live one day and enjoy that lifespan. The servant melts and Thor realises he must go back to his friends. Tuaz gives Thor food, drink and warm clothes and sends him towards a hostel over the ridge where others need leading home. When Thor gets there, he finds his stepmother, Frigga, looking after the children of Asgard. They share their sadness that Odin is gone and make their way home. Tuaz looks on and monologues. Yes, Whiteface. He's talking to his...
Who's Whiteface?
Whiteface is a bird.
Okay, is that... Thought that
yeah, that's not me talking to you.
How dare you?
Yes, Whiteface.
I thought that was a bit random. Thought like another random...
Yes. Can I read this out? And then we finish the synopsis.
Oh, okay.
Yes, Whiteface, Thor is a fine lad, is he not? I'm glad I left my footprints in the snow, that he might be drawn here to ease his grief. When last I saw him, he was but a newborn, yuling as lustily as any babe I'd ever heard. And now he has a warrior's soul, young and proud, so like his father. But I would expect no less from my great-grandson. May he walk in honour. the end. Let it go, let it go.
Bothered me anyway.
Okay, so darling, what did you think of that comic? Did you enjoy this one?
I did. Sort of like, I think it was one of the most my favourite ones of the ones we've done so far.
Oh, that's great news. I really love this story. It's actually quite atypical for Walter Simonson's Thor, which is renowned for, like, big slam bang action, lots of special effects, lots of sound effects, lots of screaming hammers throwing through the air and big battles. And actually, this is quite a quiet, subdued issue. It's about kind of the grief of losing a father. It's quite touching, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So, like, I thought that bit was quite touching. And I thought it had quite a few moments of humour.
Yeah, I mean, as a series, you know, the Walter Simonson version is known for having humorous moments in all the stories. And he was always very good at kind of bringing in little bits of other parts of the story that are setting something up or, you know, reviewing something. So you've got a bit on Thor and then you go and see his mum for a bit, or you go and see Sith and Beta Ray Bill, or you go and see the Warriors 3. But this one, definitely, it's... What's quite interesting is, in some ways, the comic's set up as, who is Tuaz? That's the story. You get that from the front page. You know, the first splash page where you've got Tuaz in shadow, stood there, he's holding the hammer, which anyone who's a Thor fan knows that not just anybody can pick that hammer up. You know, it's impossible to move if you're not a good person. So there's like a mystery there, and that gets dealt with within the issue. But actually, more of the story is about how does Thor feel about losing his dad.
Yes.
You know, and it is really interestingly done. So it's an atypical Thor story in a way, particularly for Walter Simonson. And it's also not typical for what Sal Buscema does well, what the artist does well. He's known for action. He's known for kinetic stuff. Mm. And there is action in it, and the wrestling is a good way of doing that. It's got other things going on as well. There's subtle stuff going on, but it does work quite well.
And it's not too... The pains are not too difficult to decipher what's happening, because, as you say, it's quite static.
Mm. I mean, one of the things I did say about this particular artist is he's known for his clarity.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt you can tell exactly what's happening all the time in the story just by looking at the pictures, even if you don't read the words.
And the colours would have been more vibrant and the paper less brown. That's what when it came out, I guess, maybe.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, it will have faded. The colours usually don't fade much. But they select the colours knowing that they're going onto this paper that will soak them up.
Right, okay.
So, you know, that kind of teal colour of his, of like the fur cloak that Tuaz is wearing, and his skirt probably would have been similar to the colour of the t-shirt you're wearing, much brighter, but by the time it gets on this paper it becomes duller.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So they allow for that in the colouring. I mean, one of the things I think you have to say is Christy Scheel, you know, the fact that she became a fine artist who teaches colour theory as part of her thing. And if you look at her fine art, I was googling her earlier because I knew she was a fine artist but didn't know the work. I knew that what she'd moved into, and her stuff is very much about colour, and it's kind of, it's on the edge of abstract, but not quite. It's kind of landscapes, almost abstract.
Oh, okay.
But the way she uses colour to draw your attention, and the contrast of colour, you know, something like that, splash page there.
Do you think that, okay, maybe not on this one, but do you think that there's some kind of link between Surratt and his kind of theories of
using the dots?
Yeah,
well, I mean, they do use the printing format uses dots, but so that isn't a choice. That's the only way of getting colors. But I think, you know, where color theory comes in is things like this. You know, we've talked about Tiwaz is wearing a teal colour, which is meant to be a fur. And this is set in the icy waste, so it's meant to be a natural fur.
Mm.
Natural fur is not teal coloured.
No.
You know, and yet he's wearing teal, and he's wearing teal because it makes him stand out against the background. And in some ways, that's where the cover goes wrong, because in the cover, his fur is brown, like a bear fur.
Yes.
He's wearing a natural colour, and it actually makes it harder for him to stand out, you know, against the icy background that's white and against Thor's outfit that's kind of blue and red and yellow.
Mm.
You know, teal is a nice contrast, so he really stands. I mean, that's something that Christy Scheel, as a colourist, is bringing to the storytelling to make it clearer.
It's very warm, all this.
We are suddenly feeling very, very warm.
I think it's going to
storm. I mean, I think the art is absolutely beautiful. I love the scene in New York City. So let me just say what I was saying again, because I cut it off. I love the scene in New York City where they're walking around. And I love this thing. It's a real Marvel Comics thing. And it makes sense within that storyline of Marvel Comics that, you know, you've got these people who are gods who are wearing the most ridiculous outfits, wandering around, and everyone's like, yeah, whatever, I've seen that before. Oh, it was Galactus here, it must be Tuesday. Nobody's reacting to it. And you actually asked me, didn't you? You said, is it an alternate Earth?
Yeah.
Because was it that fact, the fact that they weren't reacting, or...?
No, I just... There is possibly one lady reacting in the background.
Oh, yeah, she is slightly reacting, isn't she, with a little bun on. I think she might just be looking at Hogan the Grimm's bottom.
Oh, okay.
Actually, she won't be able to see it because he's got that leather skirt on.
Yeah, but he's probably got a fine bottom.
Oh, I imagine he has, Hogan the Grimm, and also Fandral the Dashing.
Is he the green chappy?
Fandral the Dashing is the green chappy. And then we got Volstagg the... Well, he's called lots of things. Volstagg the Mighty, Volstagg the Enormous, Volstagg the...
So, and also the Shakespearean thing as well. Actually, it wasn't Shakespearean. It was...
There was Bible. An element of Shakespearean, wasn't there? That kind of...
There was a Bible reference in here, which I thought was quite good.
Oh, yeah, him quoting... Tiwaz quotes the Bible, doesn't he? At Thor at one point, and says it was written by a great poet. And it is from Ecclesiastes, which is one of the bits that's written by a poet. It's poetry.
We have to look that up.
Yeah, I did have to look it up. Sorry. I have a theology degree and I did not remember where that was from.
I mean, to be fair, have you ever read Ecclesiastics?
Yeah, I told you. In my first year at university, at one point, our Christmas homework in the first year of biblical studies was to read the whole Bible in order so that we knew what was in there.
Oh.
Yeah, there's a lot of begetting in the middle. I tell you, goes on for a long time.
And what does Ecclesiastics?
It's poetry. It's one of the poetry ones.
Is it?
Yeah, quite a lot of the Old Testament is more kind of poetry and songs and psalms. There's quite a lot of it that isn't. Actually, it's Ecclesiastes New Testament. I might edit this out because I sound stupid. No, I love the bit, though, when they're in New York. And that kind of, I don't know, I love Volstagg. I always have. You know, he's a real character that I love.
He's a bit like Falstaff.
Yeah, I mean, definitely based on Falstaff. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I thought that, yeah.
No, there's no doubt at all. You know, it's in, everyone agrees, Jack Kirby designed that character based on a Falstaff.
He's a kind of sort of mead drinking, good time.
And I think Fandral's meant to be almost like a Robin Hood figure.
Oh, okay.
I don't know quite what Hogan would be, Hogan the Grimm. I'm trying to think what else might be worth mentioning. I mean, there's that little bit with the guys in the metal suits, which is just like a setup for a future story, and you've no idea. And do you know what? I haven't read the next stories that feature that for quite a few years, so I can't really remember myself.
It's a different sort of like, and I like also what I do like about this style of comic is that it's not pretending to be anything but they're desperately trying to get you to read other issues with their cross-referencing. And their little things of this story was in issue
Yeah, but they refer back to the old ones. And, I mean, actually, the way that Walt Simonson designs his stories, and he does that, his first issue, this story takes place just after Odin goes missing because he's in a fight with Surtr. And Surtr's been like built, he's like the fire god.
Right.
In Asgardian, and he's meant to be involved in Ragnarok. He's been on the first page of Simonson's first issue on the book. So about 20 issues ago, there's like a mysterious figure doing something and he goes, doom, you know, and that's Surtr. And he got defeated the issue before this.
Right.
So that's been like one story. And all the time there's been like a little, like a page here, a page there, building that up. And then this has got a page here, a page there, building up new things. So, it, you know, it shows you there's the bit where Loki and, what's she called, the girl? I did say, but I've forgotten her name because I'm an idiot. Loki and, what's she called? The one who's meant to look like Debbie Harry. Lorelei. Loki and Lorelei getting together to work together. So if you've been reading the series up to this point, you would have seen that Lorelei had been trying to seduce Thor and it hadn't worked. So Lorelei is now working with Loki to try and take advantage of Odin being gone. And become in charge of, you know, the of Asgard. You know, you've got that page with those kind of metal-suited warriors. You've got the little subplot of Sith knows what happened. So, you know, during the fight against Surtr's warriors, some of the people were fighting on Earth, and lots of Asgardians went to help them there. Mm-hmm. And then the other lot were fighting in Asgard. So during that, Sith goes back to Asgard briefly and then comes back to Earth. So she's the only one who saw the stuff in Asgard, knows that, you know, Thor's missing, but not dead, that Odin is probably dead, although it's comic books and nobody actually thinks he's dead, knows that a lot of the city's destroyed, and all these other people in New York going, oh, what a fun time, we won that war.
Mm.
And actually, she knows what's going on. So there's that, you know, there's a little bit of the romance. There's references to, you know, Volstagg taking things back for his wife. And then his wife and children are part of the, his children are involved, you know, in the bit with Frigga. Right. And you've got the thing that they're going to start traveling back to Asgard with the kids who had gone away to hide. Because there was going to be a big war in Asgard, so they'd all left. So there's like a page here, a page there, just like setting up the next bit. And you're right, it does create a situation where it's saying you have to read the next issue.
Yeah.
Mm.
And would you, the thing that I thought with Lorelei was that it was the same name as the Marilyn Monroe character in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
Yeah, that could be part of it.
Is that a coincidence?
I don't know where he got the name from. I don't think Lorelei is the name of a Norse goddess. I don't think it's a Norse word, is it?
No, I don't think so.
But she is, there's a character who's a regular in Thor, you know, going back to the Stanley Jack Kirby days, called Amara, the Enchantress. And she's like this kind of villainous woman who wants to seduce people and get them in their power and stuff. Latin and German, it says we've looked it up.
Yeah, Laurel or Sweet Bay.
Of course,
Bay Tree.
From the Bay Tree. Yeah, that makes sense.
Symbol of victory, lurking rock.
Mm. It could well be based upon the Marilyn Monroe thing. She was basically, she's that character, I was talking about the Enchantresses, she's her younger sister.
Oh, okay.
Who doesn't really get anywhere because her sister's this big character. And the idea is she wants to make her own way. So she goes to Earth. And she moves in next door to Thor's human version, and she's trying to seduce him.
Somebody painted a picture of somebody called Lorelei in 1899. So.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's an old name, and
maybe it is Norse mythology.
Mm.
There are locks and rivers, Rhine, German. So the Norse aren't that far away.
Maiden named Lorelei lives on the rock and lures fishermen to their death. So that's like a variation of the Circe thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it could be that, because it's about her trying to enchant Thor and falling in love with her. Now, okay. One thing Walter Simonson did do is he did investigate Norse myths and use them. So, you know, a lot of the earlier Thor stories had Norse myths in there, but it was like the basic stuff everyone knows. So everyone knows Thor, everyone knows Loki, everyone knows Odin. I did look some of this up because I'm a sad man. And apparently wrestling is a key part of certain Norse myths. Oh. Although the Norse myth where Thor wrestles, what he actually does is he wrestles a personification of old age.
Right.
To show that everyone, even the gods, have to deal with aging.
Okay, so it's not just a homoerotic...
No, not really. And...
He's a big hammer.
There's also a Tiwaz in Norse mythology.
Okay.
But Tiwaz apparently was a god from a different one, and I think he turned into Tyr, which is a god that people will have heard of, the one-armed guy who... God of war.
Okay.
But then he's also, like, sometimes made out to be, like, sometimes he's, like, one of Odin's children, sometimes he's one of Odin's parents or grandparents. So it's kind of a vague character in Norse mythology who comes over from older Germanic stuff.
Okay.
So, I mean, obviously he's looking at that when he's coming up with this. He needs a character name for someone who he's going to make the great-grandfather of Thor, so therefore the grandfather of Odin.
Who knew that people would be coming into this podcast and learning about Norse mythology?
Exactly, exactly. I know. It's quite interesting to look it up. But no, I mean, I love this comic. And the question that I always say is, should I love this comic? What do you think, darling?
I think it's very good.
Should I love it then?
I think you should. Unlike a lot of the comics that my beloved has given me to read, I think this one is possibly one where I would want to read the following to find out what happened next. So that is always the point of reading, isn't it?
Well, maybe I should, somewhere I've got, I'm reading the original one here we've been looking at in this issue, you know, which I got as a back issue. Somewhere I've got the collected editions, you know, the Thor Legends Walter Simonson run. I bought them like a lot of people did because they're amazing. I would recommend you read this. It is a great comic. I should love it. It will go down in history, I think, as one of the best comics of the 1980s, this run of Thor. And actually, the whole run is better than any individual issue. So this is a great issue, but if you read the whole thing, it's better. Indeed. So yes, I should love this comic. Yes,
well done.
We would normally move on to feedback. We haven't actually had any feedback this time.
Well, there you go. Maybe there that's because go. We did it so well the last time.
Maybe we got everything right and nobody disagreed with us on any points whatsoever.
Or maybe it's just because very few people have yet heard of our
podcast, which we're still promoting out there. Eventually we will manage to get it to work on iTunes, which we haven't managed to do yet. But I don't have an Apple ID, so that's very difficult for me. So just a reminder to anyone's listening, we would love your feedback. If you want to let us know what you think, we have a Blogspot page, which is shouldilovethis.blogspot.com. I'm looking at you for confirmation and you've got a look on your face if you don't know. No, it is shouldilovethis.blogspot.com.
That's quite difficult to say.
It is quite difficult to say. I should have given this a different title, really. Should I love this is a bit clumsy, isn't it, grammatically?
Maybe we can call it, I don't know.
I love this.
I love this.
We love comics. That's a bit of a rubbish title, is that? But no, we are looking for your feedback. I'd love to hear what people think of it and what their opinions are of both the comics, the creators we cover. And, you know, did I miss something? You know, I've only been reading comics for, how old am I?
A long time.
Yeah, 40 plus years. I've missed stuff. There's stuff I don't know about. I make errors. I talk to Irrigal as though I know everything. I don't. Please let us know. Please get involved. And if you want to interact with us directly, straight away, on social media, I'm at Whiter Trash on the Twitters.
The Twitters.
And what are you on the Twitters, darling? At
Irrigale32.
Irrigale32. Because clearly this man is 32 years old. And 1975 was 32 years ago. Okay, and on that bombshell, let's say goodbye. And yes, I should love this comic. Thank you very much.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Him up on
briefly.
You looked him up on Wikipedia while I was talking.
I did, yeah.
I find that funny. Did it agree with me, Wikipedia?
It said that you had lots more. He did lots. He did Aliens, which I think you mentioned.
Oh.
And I think it said a lot. It didn't say that that thing you said changed comics though.
Okay. He did that.